Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of Melbourne Writers Festival. You're listening to a conversation from our 2021 podcast series, which is supported by the Copyright Agency's Cultural Fund.
Hello, my name is Tasneem Chopra, and I am a guest interviewer for the Melbourne Writers Festival. I respectfully acknowledge that today I'm speaking from the lands of the Kulin Nation, in particular the Wurundjeri and the Woiwurrung people. I pay my respects to their elders and to the elders of all communities and cultures across Australia. In this podcast, I will be speaking with the fabulous Meherin Farooqi, author of Too Migrant, Too Muslim, Too Loud. Meherin has been described as the first Muslim woman to sit in an Australian parliament. She's a Green senator and lifelong feminist and anti-racist activist as well. Her story takes a no-holds-bar approach in her memoir, as she recounts arriving from Pakistan in 1992 with a young family, two suitcases, a career as a civil servant and environmental engineer, and her ascent into political outside life in a white man's world. She strived to change it without being changed herself. Welcome, Meherin, to this podcast.
Assalamu alaikum, Tasneem.
Alaikum salam.
Hello, and it's so lovely to have this chat with you. And I'd also like to acknowledge that I'm meeting with you from the land of the Gadigal people, and I pay my respects to elders past and present. No matter where we are in this country, we are on stolen land. This is, always was, and always will be Aboriginal land.
Thank you, Meherin. I want to start from the start. I know we only have 30 minutes, but I want to just put things in a little bit of context for listeners who might be listening to you for the first time or don't know about the legend of Meherin Farooqi, because it's something that needs a bit of grounding and context to really appreciate the impetus. You were born in Pakistan and raised there. You pursued, presumably, a career in a non-traditional field, as far as what Pakistani girls would do, generally speaking. Can you just give us a bit of an insight into your family life and what shaped your decisions to go into the field that you did?
Yeah, I mean, writing this book, Tasneem, made me reflect a lot more on, you know, life growing up. Like, you never really think about your life when you're growing up. Like, who has that luxury to do that? But this book really made me do that. I think it was a pretty average kind of life. Two brothers, me and a younger sister, my dad and mom, a middle-class family. My dad was a professor at uni, and we actually lived on campus with all the other workers at uni. My mom tells me that from a very young age, I did have this irksome habit of arguing about things with her and my dad. And those things were mainly to start off with not being allowed to do things that my two older brothers were allowed to do in Pakistan. So things like, you know, playing cricket on the street with the other neighborhood kids, or flying kites from the roof of our home. And I just could never understand why we weren't able to do that. Obviously, as you grow up a bit, you understand this thing called sexism and gender inequality. But I think fairness was part of the battle that I had with a lot of people growing up in a society where, the gender inequality is entrenched. But you find out later on, and when I moved to Australia, that it's not confined to a culture or a country, that, you know, gender inequality, sexism, misogyny has no boundaries. And it's a patriarchal system that's everywhere. So that was kind of my early growing up. But, you know, my fondest memories are about the long summer holidays that we had in Pakistan, 3 months over summer, spending a lot of time with my grandparents, you know, who had no restrictions on what I could or couldn't do.
Which is quite the opposite of what you had been maybe socialized into to living through. And I mean, the next question I wanted to ask, which is a segue from that, is, I mean, who were the role models that might have influenced you in, I guess, being your best self and walking into the change that you knew was not going to be conventional?
A lot of fantastic women growing up in my life. Really incredible. I mean, I so fondly remember the camaraderie of the women around me in my life. You know, my mother, she's generous, kind, trusting. And she does break the mold in her own way. Like, she learned to use the internet when she was in her 70s.
Oh.
You know, because all the children had gone overseas. And she uses social media much better than I do at the moment. She keeps us all connected through Facebook.
Yeah.
And she just told me, you know, she started downloading this podcast that my son does. She had hassled me a bit to send it to her. And then she said, I gave up and I just figured out how to download it myself. And she's 84 now.
Cool, auntie. And wow.
I know. I had an aunt who was fiercely independent and feminist. And I can remember her having these fights about feminism, in family gatherings. Then I had a mother-in-law, very lucky to have a mother-in-law, who just did what had to be done without actually seeking any recognition. And like I said, my grandmother. So very lucky to be around these incredible, strong women. But in terms of political figures, obviously in Australia, I saw no role model. There was no one like me in politics, till I got there.
Yeah.
But I do have a lot of kind of, I guess, mentorship, you can say, in the sense about reading what these people wrote. So Arundhati Roy.
Yeah.
I have amazing. I just love her so much and what she writes because it is bold and it tells the truth. And it just, because she is also from the same part of the world that I come from, the subcontinent, hits a nerve, the colonialism and the oppression and how that still carries on.
Mm-hmm.
And then people like Angela Davis.
Yes.
As well, and Martin Luther King. And I think they talk about not just racism, but the intersection of racism with so many other societal issues like poverty,
mm-hmm.
And sexism. And those, you could say, were the influences on me growing up, but also till now as well.
Well, and that's the thing, isn't it? These episodes of misogyny and patriarchy and class inequality, they were things that you witnessed both in Pakistan and then in Australia. I mean, they're here as well. People who often want to, look at migrant people and think, well, your country is so backward. So inequity, women are this, that, and the other. You then look at Australia and, I mean, how do you respond to those that typecast you coming from a place where they think everything's gone wrong?
That's something that quite surprised me when I came to Australia, because having grown up in Pakistan, which was a colonial country, you have this narrative of, these so-called developed countries, that they have achieved gender equality, that they are corruption-free, that they are so much better than we are, because that's what's been drilled into you, through school, through, other places. But that's not the reality at all. I left Pakistan. One of the big reasons my husband and I actually left Pakistan was because corruption had become so entrenched in society, in politics. And we had both grown up with families that had very strong values on integrity and honesty. And it just didn't sit well with us when we were in our working life. We didn't want our kids to have to always fight that system. And so we were like, okay, let's go to a place where, we think it's corruption free and, there's such higher standards. Lo and behold, to my shock, my first year in New South Wales Parliament, 10 or 11 Liberal MPs had to go to the backbench or leave politics because of corruption allegations.
Wow.
And we can see at the moment what's going on. I mean, it's a huge deal. So you do find out that, power corrupts no matter where you are.
How long into your arrival in Australia did you realise that there was a certain amount of corruption and malaise and problems with the society that you'd perhaps at one stage idealised? So how long before that happened? And then after that, how long the ascent into politics?
I guess I might start a little bit before that. The reason why I came to Australia was because my dad had come here in 1957 on the Colombo Plan, which was a scholarship program for people from, the global south to study. And so he came to Sydney and he wasn't married then or had any kids, but he came back and, we came along and we grew up watching he was an amazing kind of cameraman, and he had photos and slides and movies of Sydney. And we grew up, watching the Harbour Bridge and the Opera House. And he said to us that Sydney was the most beautiful place that he had ever visited.
Okay.
And so I came to Sydney with visions, of course, of an idealistic place, which had reached gender equality, where you know, politics was corruption free. What I did know about Australia was that it was a very multicultural society, that people from all over the world had come there. I mean, growing up in Pakistan, it's quite monocultural, you could say. Everyone, almost everyone there looks like me. So I was really looking forward to being exposed to, I hadn't been outside of Pakistan till then. And I was really looking forward to being exposed to so many different people. And when I did come here in 1992, my first impression of Australia was that it had worked hard to be an egalitarian society. In Pakistan, there are still very deep divisions between the rich and the poor, you know, the educated and the not so educated. And when I came here, I did feel that, you know, in the same neighborhood, everyone lived, you know, you had a doctor, you had a tradesperson, everyone with different backgrounds and professions and would live there. But obviously, as I learned a little bit more, my rose-colored glasses did come off, especially when you learn about the history of Australia, how it was settled.
So did you have any idea of that prior to coming from Pakistan?
Not much at all. A little bit, but, you know, not much at all. And I really found out about it when I got here. And the more you learn about it, of course, you realize what is actually going on in society. But I must say that in the 30 years, almost 30 years that I've been here at Tasneem, things have changed a lot as well. I think for the worse, for people like me. I did feel it was an egalitarian society. I did feel welcomed. We did feel that there was a lot more support for new migrants at that time point in time, even though it was very, very hard for us to find jobs. And now, you know, it had a lot to do with resume racism. But I think in the last few decades, things have really shifted for the worse with the race baiting, the dog whistling on migrants, on asylum seekers, and the injustices for First Nations people continue on. And I think the political class has has to take responsibility for that.
I mean, you've been described as someone who's a complete mix of all the places that you've lived in, and as a hardcore intersectional feminist. How do you bring that intersectional lens to the platforms that you occupy?
The intersectional lens for me obviously just comes naturally, right? You are a woman, you are a woman of color in, like I've described many times, in a white man's world. So for me, you know, things like, for example, climate justice and racial justice are so interlinked, which, you know, still we generally, the public is coming to the realization that that's the case. And so for me, any issue, any legislation that is raised, I just, you know, look at it from particularly the lens of gender and race, especially. And that's not understood. I was going to say, it's you know, I still get heckled for doing that in the Senate.
So you get heckled for bringing up issues of sexism or racism in Parliament, and yet, as somebody who, and you've been very frank about the experiences that you've had, the vile racism and the vicious racism that you've experienced, particularly since your ascent into Parliament, do you think that lived experience that you can bring with the, I guess, the status of a Member of Parliament now has the potential to shift the narrative in government?
I hope it does, but the issue is that there are still so few of us in parliaments, you know, around decision-making tables with that sort of lived experience that a vast majority of our community actually live with. Like, our parliaments are so unrepresentative of our streets and suburbs that those issues are still swept under the carpet. And, you know, COVID-19 was a classic example of how that happens when the government provided extra support for people during COVID-19. The people who didn't get that support were migrant workers, were international students. People in Western and Southwestern Sydney felt the crackdown of police, you know, and of the armed forces like no one else in this country. And I see one of the big reasons of that is that our voices are just not present there in parliaments, and it's very easy to disregard us So of course that needs to change. But from my perspective, I hope one of the big reasons I actually went into politics was hoping to make life for others like me a little bit easier, who wanted to take the same journey as me. I don't think I'll be able to bash down those doors that have been so tightly locked to us, but I hope to at least a little bit ajar.
But it's important, Mehreen, it's important to celebrate the affirmations that you've had from people in the community who can tell you, Mehreen, since you've been in government, I feel this way about politics, I feel this way about Australia, I feel there's hope. What have been some of the comments that you've heard that give you a sense of satisfaction that I'm glad I'm doing what I'm doing? Because I'm sure there's many days where you'll bang your head against the wall and think, why? What was I thinking? But what about the days where you think, oh, it's worth it? What do they look like and how do they happen?
Absolutely. I mean, little things that you never think of, like, you know, I get messages from people telling me how wonderful it is for them to see me in the shalwar kameez, for instance, you know, just the Punjabi dress. And that people tell me that they see someone who represents them. So many young women, especially from South Asia, say the same thing. You know, they tell me that they see their stories reflected when I speak. Their experiences are being told through my voice. And I think that's really important. And that was the same part of writing this book as well, because people have often said to me, you know, what drove you to take on this massive job? As you know, it is a massive job to write a book on top of everything else that you have on your plate. And that was a big part of it. I have become really concerned about the divisiveness of politics in this country, the rise of the far right, and the lack of people in parliament who actually experience the brunt of those issues. And so I think stories like ours should be told and voices like ours should be heard. And I think people need to know this while I'm in parliament, you know, so we can together try and do something about it. And also, I mean, I'm still adamant that you can do politics on your own terms.
How is it working out for you doing politics on your terms?
I wouldn't do it any other way. The point of me being in politics is to tell it like it is. What's the point in being in a system and becoming part of the system when you went there to change it? Of course, it's harder. Of course, it's the system is stacked against you. So for so many reasons, I mean, I'm a total outsider to politics in many more ways than one. Like, I migrated here when I was in my 20s, you know, I had no connections here, no networks, those boys clubs networks, or, you know, I hadn't come through the, you know, the student politics in Australia. So for me, it was an entirely new world. But I think that's an advantage.
Absolutely. And that's people seeing you, seeing themselves for the first time represented on a political platform. Whether it's Desi women, whether it's people in Shalwar, whether it's, you know, Australian Muslim migrants, they can see that somehow suddenly leadership at this level, A, becomes aspirational, but they see someone with your background occupying a platform who's had lived experiences of their microaggressions and macro, admittedly, to do that. Do you feel, though, in the process of that, that has somehow put on pressure for you to maybe address issues that are beyond the scope of one person?
I think most issues are beyond the scope of one person. And I have never kind of adhered to the philosophy that I can make a change as one person. Change always happens collectively. And that's the big part of the, you know, the party or the political movement that I joined, which is a grassroots political movement. So the best of politics for me is working with the community. It's not in parliament. It is actually the people who live and breathe on our streets that inspire me about politics. That's where change has always come from, and that's where change will always come from. Of course, because we have the system where, you know, decisions are still made in parliaments, but those decisions are only made or changed because the people show their will of, you know, making those changes and making the system better.
Well, speaking of making systems better, in your book you outline you know, an array of different issues that you've campaigned on and advocated for, everything from outlawing greyhound racing to breaking the silence in Parliament on addressing issues of removing laws on abortion, victims of stories of women around the world, issues concerning mining pipelines where Indigenous people have lived, ending TAFE debts at university. I mean, if there's a major issue to be felt at the heartland of Australian politics, what either working classes or minorities are enduring, you're out there advocating for those. Do you feel that when you advocate for these, you're always advocating for them in a vacuum? Do you feel supported by your party or the political system when you do this?
It varies, I think. It varies issue by issue. A vast majority of times, I feel the aloneness of sometimes being a lone voice. Just because I am, you know, like being a first in a system is an immense, immense privilege. But it says a lot when you are the first in the system that there are barriers and difficulties for people like us to be in that system. So, of course, it is difficult. And there is that aspect of being on your own, trying to fight the good fight. But things are changing, Tasneem, I can tell you that. There are more people in parliaments who recognize the need to be vocal about this. And those people will only speak out about issues that concern marginalized communities in two ways, I guess. One is that those marginalized communities are themselves represented in parliament, and the other is that those communities actually become more active in raising those issues. And when I talk to the communities, you know, from my background, for instance, I often say to them, no one's going to roll out a red carpet for us. You know, we've got to roll up our sleeves.
Yeah.
And although it shouldn't be completely on us, that responsibility shouldn't be completely on us. But what I have seen in politics, I do see that we will have to do it ourselves. I mean, just the recent kind of debate about the electorate of Fowler in New South Wales, where an incredible woman of colour, you know, is ready to have a go to represent her electorate. But we've seen the Labour Party has parachuted another candidate. Is indication enough that we are still second class in this country? Mm. And, you know, we still have to fight our way up. No one's going to say, okay, I've made a space for you. Come, because we need you at the decision-making table. So I think that we still have a very long way to go, but we won't get there unless we ourselves take up the mantle and push for it.
Brilliantly said. Can you summarise from your experience in Parliament so far, what has been the lowest point for you since you've been involved and the highest point?
I mean, if you look at politics at the moment, you would think it's all very low, from anywhere from corruption to, you know, inaction on the climate crisis to dealing with inequality. But politics is a roller coaster ride, you know. It has its wonderful moments. It has the good, the bad, and the ugly. And, you know, I've experienced all of that. And sometimes the lowlights and the highlights can actually come together as well.
Okay.
So, you know, I'll give you the example of the decriminalization of abortion campaign that I started with many, many thousands of people when I got into New South Wales Parliament. And I think it's one of the most difficult things I've done in many ways to this point. And the reason for that is that there was a lot of opposition to it, not just from the usual suspects, the conservatives and, you know, the anti-choicers, but also, surprisingly for me, from so-called progressives as well, who just didn't want me to speak at all because they thought something really bad would happen. And some of them were kind of in the Labour Party. And, you know, I've written quite a bit about this in the book. And I think they were all pro-choice people, but their party hadn't allowed them to make this change. And it seemed to me that they didn't want anyone else to do it either. So I think to fight that on two fronts was hard. But I also knew that, you know, overwhelmingly in the community, people were ready to make that change. And although my bill didn't succeed, and it is very hard for bills of minor parties to succeed, what we did do was break that silence and build that momentum so much that 2 years after I had put my bill up, that change happened. And, you know, I thought that day I was in Sydney, although I was in the Australian Parliament at that time. I went into the chamber and I was wondering how I would feel. Would I feel bitter that it wasn't my bill that passed? But like I was walking on air. It was just incredible to see that, you know, that basic right of bodily autonomy given to women. So I guess, yeah, those highlights and lowlights can sometimes come together. But, you know, in the last couple of years, a lowlight for me has been the complete abandonment of the higher education sector by the Australian government. You know, the international students, the universities didn't get JobKeeper. Fees has been raised so much. And, you know, thousands of university workers have lost their jobs. And having been a university academic, if I ever wanted to be something in life, it was always a teacher. And having been there and having so much respect, you know, for our university workers and teachers everywhere, it's just been devastating to see that happen.
Oh, gosh. Well, I guess to flip that on its head, what is it, though, that gives you a sense of hope about the future?
Oh, there is so much. There is so much. I mean, you wouldn't be doing what I'm doing if I didn't have hope. I mean, lately it's been the young students who've come out and, you know, fighting the fight for their future on the climate crisis. It has been, I think, I haven't seen anything as inspiring as them in my time in Australia. It has just been incredible. The resurgence of the Black Lives Matter movement.
Yes.
Is changing.
Amazing.
It's changing things all over the world. I mean, I think Australia is still trying to push back on that, but it's inevitable. It is inevitable that things will change. In Parliament, just in the last 18 months, two of my new colleagues are both First Nations women. And that's just so, so fantastic to see. And this year we have seen Australian women really fight back against sexism, misogyny, sexual harassment.
Yeah.
And some of the young women who have stood up so boldly and kind of had the courage to tell their truth, and more people are believing them.
For sure.
So, you know, things definitely are changing. But my hope, Tasneem, always comes from the people I meet outside of parliaments.
That's promising. It is promising. And I think you have a shared hope with most Australians, actually, for that specific reason. I've just got a couple more questions before we end. First is, what are the two top changes that you'd love to see actioned in Parliament in the next 5 years? Some of them might have a strong guess, but I want to hear from you what they might be.
I think the top one would be treaties with First Nations people. Really, that has to be. Because at the core of what we are at the moment in Australia, the systems that have been institutionalized, which project the racism into society, we have to deal with those. And they stem from the injustices that are happening to our First Nations people. So treaties would be my topmost, because I think going on from there,
number one,
we can really change the systems. I guess the next one from my perspective would be to look at free university and TAFE education.
Again, I think you'd have millions of Australians cheering you on for that one.
Yeah, absolutely. It has to be in a country as rich and wealthy as Australia. There's absolutely no reason why we can't do that, why education shouldn't be accessible, you know, to every single person in this country. And then if I could say a third one, I think they're all on par, action on climate.
Well, that goes without saying, I think. I always expected that one of you, so, you know, totally. Look, last question. What would you tell 17-year-old Mehreen in Pakistan who was maybe going into university or thinking about going to university about what to prepare for as she got older? What would you tell her?
So 17, I was in high school. I actually went to a convent school in Lahore, very strict, always being told, you know, don't do this, don't do that. You know, when you did things wrong, you were kind of hit on your hands with the sharp side of the ruler. So, you know, I would tell 17-year-old Maureen to not let others define who you are by the mistakes that you may have made or they think that you may have made. Not let others define you by the labels that they might describe you with. Because 17, I mean, it is a time when you are trying to find out who you are and placing yourself in the context of the world around you. And, you know, if fear is the fear of making mistakes is driving you, then you won't be able to do that. So, you know, the one piece of advice that I would give them is advice that I got when I was at university here in Sydney, which is feel the fear and do it anyway.
Ooh, I do like that.
Because when you are feeling fear, you know you're onto something. It's something bold and courageous that you're about to do.
Which goes against every life lesson we've been told, right?
Absolutely. But just do it. I took that to heart.
I think that's a beautiful note to end things on. And as well as, you know, we are looking forward to your next book, which will hopefully be a compilation of your amazing recipes. I have seen the stuff that you produce on social media, and I've just got to say, you put us to shame, us wannabe desi cooks who think we have the best gulab jamun recipe, but apparently we don't. So I look forward to volume 2 of your collections.
Yeah, a glutton for punishment. Okay, I'll do it, Tasneem, just for you. Just for you.
Challenge accepted. All right. Thank you. Thank you. Maureen Farooqi, thank you so much for your time, for the candid conversation and your insights. I think, as always, they've been intuitive, but they're also so heartfelt. And you can't fake authenticity. You really can't. You bring it to the table. Thank you so much. And, yeah, please, for those of you looking for Maureen's book, it's available from Readings. The contact details and the email for Readings is on the Writers Festival website, so please do check that out. Maureen, thank you so much.
Thank you for having this chat with me, Tasneem. It's brilliant.
Thanks for listening. To support Melbourne Writers Festival, you can make a donation of any size at mwf.com.au.